is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Gregory Zuckerman. He is the author of the new book about the vaccine so far, A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. Gregory, congratulations and a very good evening to you, and thank you for this. I take you to a dramatic moment in your book. It is January 2020. Chinese researcher Zhang, headquartered at Fudan University in Shanghai, his lab is there, has received what he needs to map out the genome of what he suspects is a new version of SARS or something odd that's been reported from Wuhan, the 11 million populated city in the middle of China that is experiencing strange afflictions. He gets the material he needs to map the genome, and he calls his colleague Eddie Holmes in Australia. What does he tell him? Good evening to you, Gregory.
Good evening, and great to be back here. And yeah, you've kind of pinpointed what I think is an overlooked and very dramatic episode that was a turning point in history, frankly. So this scientist, as you mentioned, China, Zhang, a 58-year-old infectious disease expert, he basically maps the genome of this new and really troubling and even scary virus. They're not sure what it is yet, but it seems like SARS, and it seems more dangerous than the first SARS. If you recall, that one did kill some people. It was lethal, but eventually petered out, partly because, or largely because, we could identify who had been infected. And what this scientist, Zhang, gets scared about is that there are asymptomatic people that have been infected by this new virus, and he's nervous because they're asymptomatic and yet they've been infected. Well, that means this thing could spread. So he's scared and he's not sure what to do.
He makes a phone call to Australia. What does he tell his colleague?
Right. So he and this scientist, Eddie Holmes, have been working together for years, and they wrote papers together, and they investigated and researched infectious diseases together. And basically, Zhang is torn what to do. On the one hand, he wants to share the sequence, the genetic sequence, with Holmes. And Holmes says, hand it over, share it. We need to start spreading the word about this virus, and more importantly, about its genetic sequence, because then people can get working on it. Scientists around the world can start working on testing kids, can start working on drugs, maybe even a vaccine. So Holmes is like, it's time, you got to hand it over. And Zhang is aware of the dangers. If he hands it over, the authorities are not going to be happy. They're not being very transparent, the Chinese authorities. They're maybe even a little bit embarrassed that this new virus has emerged once again. They keep happening from China. Once again, there's one emerging from China. Zhang knows there could be consequences, serious consequences for him, if he hands over the genetic sequence. So he's not sure what to do.
Eddie Holmes impresses upon him, and this is the Andromeda strain moment, that this is SARS. You cannot control this. You've got to put it out to the world. He does. Eventually, Zhang puts it up on the internet. And January 10th, a man named Barney Graham at the NIH sees it, and he calls his colleague of many years, McClellan, who's on the ski slopes. Who is Graham, and who is McClellan, and what do they do about it?
Yeah, so Barney Graham and Jason McClellan are hugely important to us all. Barney Graham has been chasing viruses, trying to come up with vaccines for lethal viruses, including one called RSV, for years, for decades even. He works for the government. He's in D.C., working for the NIH. And he had a younger colleague named Jason McClellan, who once worked for the NIH and subsequently left to start his own lab at University of Texas at Austin. And he's a structural biologist. He is an expert on the structure of viruses. And he had been working on earlier vaccines for earlier coronaviruses. If we recall the first SARS, MERS, other kind of viruses, he's got this way he has developed, along with a Chinese colleague, an immigrant from China who's waiting for his green card, and there are a lot of ironies thereof. They are working on vaccines for different viruses, and they've got a way to stabilize the spike protein in the coronavirus, and they've been just waiting for the challenge, waiting for the opportunity to show the world. And Graham said, here's our chance. Here's a new virus. It's a coronavirus. Jason, will you and your colleagues work with me to develop a vaccine?
That is the beginning of the story for the pursuit of the conquest of the vaccine. But other people also are alerted that Zhang has put up the mapping of the genome of the virus. One person who sees it on Thursday, January 23rd, Stefan Bansal of Moderna. Bansal has a colorful personality, to say the least. Others see it on January 25th. For example, a man named Shaheen, who works with his colleague and his wife, Tureci. He sees it, my date here says, about the same time. He sees it on the internet. He works in Germany. And he and Tureci are migrants from Turkey, and they're involved in a company called BioNTech in Germany. Others see it. For example, Dan Baruch sees it. A man who will eventually work very closely with J&J. Everybody sees what Zhang puts up there. So I want to stop before we plunge into all these people and who they are. Your measure, Gregory, at this point, when Zhang gets that information out, it is not official, but it is believed by all of these experts who have been looking for years for solutions to other challenges, AIDS, for example, or Ebola, or flu. They've been looking at it. Do they collectively, your reporting is in depth and you've talked to so many people, do they collectively think that this day was always going to happen? A virus that has a high R-naught, that means it transmits itself easily. Eventually we'll understand that COVID-19 travels in the air with globules from human beings who cough and talk. But do they think this day is going to come, or is this a nightmare that they thought was just out of fiction and not real?
So those that I write about in my book, those I spoke to researching the book, are all experts in virology, infectious diseases, and they realize what's happening in the world. And that means mankind is encroaching on nature. There's global warming, there's increased international travel, and they all realize that we're in an age of lethal viruses. And usually they're spilled over from animals. And was it inevitable? Nothing's ever inevitable, but they were not shocked that one so lethal and so dangerous and so easily transmittable arose. Again, we had the earlier ones. MERS and SARS were scary in their own ways. We had other kind of diseases and viruses of the recent years, Zika and others. And these people, the people I write about in my book, had chased them all and tried to create vaccines for them all and got close but not quite there. Either the viruses dissipated or they failed. They came close, but they were waiting for the opportunity. They thought they had new approaches, not the old school approaches of including in a vaccine the actual virus killed or weakened. They have these new approaches, and they say, we're gonna show the world. We just needed an opportunity. And here, early 2020, when we're all scared about our future, they see the opportunity.
In other words, the old style, this dates back at least to the 18th century and the smallpox pandemic that swept through the Atlantic world, both in the colonies, America, and the Caribbean colonies, and in Great Britain. That smallpox vaccine was essentially a piece of the smallpox itself that you then injected or introduced into a human being who wasn't ill, and though they went through fevers and pustules, if they survived, they were then protected from smallpox. It later on became, and Gregory's very careful about the history here, it became possible to use cowpox to prevent smallpox. But that's the old style of vaccine making. That's what they want to improve upon. Is that correct, Gregory?
Exactly. Scientists had always dreamed of improving on existing methods. The old school way is a fine approach, including the actual piece of a virus in a vaccine, but it doesn't always work. It's sometimes dangerous for things like HIV. You really don't want to include a piece of such an awful, dangerous virus. It takes a while to get going to manufacture the vaccines. And the dream had always been to do a faster approach. And one of the methods was messenger RNA. Another is adenovirus. And they were new technologies, new generation approaches to vaccines. And the people I write about had been perfecting them, honing them for years. They just hadn't quite proved to the world that they were effective and protective.
We're going to pursue the two methodologies that Gregory just outlined. One is the messenger RNA. The other is using adenovirus. What does that mean? These are two routes to the same success. And what we have here in 2021 is both routes are successful. We go back to the beginning then of the men and women who were alerted that day in January when they see the genome of the coronavirus, of SARS is back. It's back, as Eddie Holmes says in Australia. You must tell the world it's back. Well, what is to be done? The book is Gregory Zuckerman's A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. And when we come back, Moderna. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Bass. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Zuckerman. His new book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. All these men and women who are alerted in January of 2020, where do they come from? We go first to Moderna, which is itself a combination of pursuits, anxieties, pride, accident. We take Moderna and we come down to one man, Stefan Bancel, who's born in Marseille. Gregory, this is an outsized personality. He's not a scientist. How is it that Bancel comes to run the company called Moderna? What is his life's ambition? What is his style?
So, John, the reason I began writing this book is I became so fascinated by this guy, Bancel, and his firm, and how unlikely it was that Moderna should be the one to step up and save millions of lives. So Stefan Bancel, as you say, is not a scientist. He's an engineer, Harvard MBA. He becomes the CEO of this startup called Moderna, and they're dedicated, they're focused on developing messenger RNA, this molecule, using it to develop either drugs or vaccines or both. And for years they struggle, and for years Stefan Bancel is hard on his employees. He pushes them. He drives them to the point where people literally are collapsing. I write about it in the book, in the parking lot, in the office, at home, hitting their heads, being rushed to emergency rooms or trying to keep up with the guy, and they're having difficulties. He fires people. He's hard on people. He's not very especially complimentary. He's got ups and downs. He becomes very emotional. Sometimes he's celebrating, and sometimes he's despondent when they have setbacks. And he in some ways is a kind of a Steve Jobs kind of character. He inspires people at the same time. His belief is that Moderna can save lives, and they're going to be the ones in the next crisis to do so. And people on the outside are skeptical. They don't believe him. He seems a little bit like an Elizabeth Holmes kind of character, a salesman, raises tons and tons of money, but they're very secretive as a firm. People on the outside are very suspicious. And we get to the point to the end of 2019 where they had gone public. The stock is down. They're starting to cut costs. The pressure is building on Bancel and his firm, and they still have not proven to the world that they can develop either a vaccine or a drug that's effective and protective.
The doubts were because of messenger RNA. And Gregory takes us back to the beginning of this story, if there is a beginning. It's really a conversation held over many years between schools, between researchers, between what are called labs. When you get a grant, you set up a lab and you hire assistants. Messenger RNA was always seen as a possibility for fooling the body to think that you can let us in. You don't have to fight us. We've got something new for you. We can train you so you can resist a virus. But it was easily rejected. It was very difficult to introduce. And you introduce us to two researchers. I want to bring them in, Gregory, because they can get lost in the swim here. Carrico and Weissman, who first meet at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital in the 20th century, and they believe in messenger RNA, but nobody else does. I get the feeling, Gregory, that today, if we went to one of these big drug companies and said, you know, let's use messenger RNA, despite the success, people would still doubt it. Do I read that correctly?
Yes, many would. I'll tell you why, and I'll tell you what's remarkable about all their work. So basically, messenger RNA is a molecule. We have it inside us. It delivers the instructions, the message, as it were, from the DNA to the part of the cell where proteins are created to keep us alive. And the dream had always been, well, what if instead we created mRNA, created this molecule in the lab to instruct our body to do anything we wanted? We could actually transform our bodies into drug factories. You want some sort of protein that's at the heart of some shot, some vaccine or some drug. We can give it an instruction in the lab, put it in a vaccine, inject in the body, and ta-da. And that was always the dream, but also people were skeptical for good reasons. mRNA is chopped up really quickly by the cell's enzymes. It lasts just moments. So it's really unstable. It's not something you want to really depend on. The conventional wisdom in the world of science is don't waste your time with mRNA. And as you suggest, there were these two stubborn, persistent scientists at Penn who ignored, forget about the conventional wisdom, they ignored their own colleagues. They ignored the administrators at Penn who said, stop wasting your time on mRNA. And Carrico and Weissman persisted, and they figured out a way to change the chemical basis of this molecule, mRNA, just a little bit, switching one chemical, it's called uridine, for another one called pseudouridine, and suddenly this mRNA was able to evade the immune system and get into the cells. And why do we want that? Well, then they could instruct the cells to do, they thought, pretty much anything you want. You want to create a protein, you could do it. And it was a remarkable breakthrough that has changed everything and showed a way where we could start using mRNA to maybe make therapeutics and vaccines.
Though Carrico and Weissman do not get the company they want to build on their discovery, dated 2005, Moderna, which is a combination of modified and RNA, you get it? It sounds like modern, but it's Moderna. Moderna follows this methodology, and Bansal believes in it, but they're pursuing drugs, not vaccines. Why drugs, Gregory? What is their ambition?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what's interesting about my book is I look at it as sort of it's a relay race in some ways, where someone runs a lap, is strong, some team, some scientist, and then they stumble and fall and they barely pass the baton to the next team. And that's kind of what happened. Carrico and Weissman looked like they were going to be the ones, and they failed. They couldn't raise money. They couldn't convince anyone. They never developed any kind of drug. It's not even clear what they did would have. It was an approach that in concept was a great one, but there was a lot more work that needed to be done. That's what happened at Moderna. And it was the kind of thing where Moderna and Bansal spent years making improvements. And as you suggest, first they tried drugs. And originally the company was called Moderna Therapeutics, not vaccines, because therapeutics, drugs, are kind of what drug companies want to develop. Vaccines are kind of, until this last year, were seen as a loser kind of business. Vaccines are given every year, once a lifetime maybe, every once in a blue moon. There's just so much you can charge for a vaccine. You get pressure, you get criticism if you charge too much, especially in third world countries. Whereas a drug, you know, a statin, every day you take a statin. So for years, Moderna, Bansal and his colleagues tried to develop effective drugs using this messenger RNA molecule, and they failed.
We'll leave them with failure, Gregory. We'll come back to this. The book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. Next up, a genius. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Zuckerman. His new book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine taking place over many decades, certainly here over all of the 21st century so far. The methodology of RNA, not proved yet, but it's the methodology that Moderna is following. Now we go to a genius, a man who is gifted, enormously gifted. His name is Dan Baruch. He is so gifted, his colleagues working with him at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and elsewhere come up with an adjective meaning Baruchian, that your style is Baruchian. Gregory, what do we need to know about Dan Baruch and how eventually he will come to Johnson & Johnson?
So we talked about mRNA, and there were people like Ben Sell and Moderna spending years working on that and improving that approach. But there was another approach at the same time that other scientists around the world were trying to improve and hone, and it was also controversial. And that's what Dan Baruch was doing. It was an approach using a virus, taking a virus and using it as a vaccine, as the basis of a vaccine. And what Dan Baruch did is use something called Ad26. It's a harmless cold virus. And you say, well, why would you inject a virus in your body to heal, to teach the body as part of a vaccine? Well, they changed the composition, the chemical composition of this Ad26 virus. Baruch was able to make it harmless. So it's a harmless virus. And the idea being you're going to shepherd in a genetic message. The virus is going to be injected in the body. And it's going to carry a message. And what's that message? It's going to tell the immune system to create a protein. And he was focused on HIV. And the whole idea was to create a protein, an HIV protein in the body. And you say to yourself, well, what's the point of that? Well, it's to teach the immune system to identify that protein. And then if the body ever encounters that protein, the real thing, as part of the real virus, the HIV virus in Baruch's case, then the body will fight it off. So it's an education. That's what a vaccine is. Education. And Baruch was convinced that using this harmless virus, Ad26 it was called, he could create a vaccine that would protect the body from HIV.
So he's pursuing a vaccine for AIDS. He also, along the way, deals with Ebola. They're pursuing a way to vaccinate against Ebola. They've got a mission that they can't complete. It's enormously frustrating to them, but we need to spend a moment about Dan Baruch as an example of all of these personalities. These are very gifted people who are difficult colleagues, difficult students, difficult in the world because of their perfectionism. Gregory, are they aware that they're extraordinary human beings who are difficult to get along with? Do they accept it as part of the, what you'd have to say, what you give up in order to get to be a genius?
I don't think they're self-aware, frankly. And you and I are on the outside, and I make these observations, but they're brilliant, but they're not the most self-aware types of people. And Dan Baruch is driven, he's ambitious, he's creative, he's the best. He's what you want in a scientist. He's the perseverance is remarkable. But he's not necessarily somebody you want to have a beer with, John. He's not, as I said, self-aware. He's driven, though. That's what you want. He in his whole life has been dedicated to developing a vaccine for AIDS. He may not be the kind of person you want to schmooze with over a six-pack, but that's okay too.
He had me when I learned that he practices violin every day for philosophy's sake. It's wonderful.
At like 5 a.m. Yeah, this be well before everybody else is turning over and getting ready to get up. He's practicing violin and does it with his daughters right now, early in the morning. He's an impressive guy.
He also has feuds that last for a long time, and the feuds are over something that you wouldn't notice. It's whether someone disagrees with the conclusion you've come to or thinks you've made a mistake. These are perfectionists. So let's go to another personality very similar from another culture. This is Uygur Shaheen and Aslam Tureci. These are two scientists originally from Turkey working in Germany. Shaheen and Tureci have an idea also for pursuing vaccines, pursuing solutions to AIDS, but they're using the messenger RNA route, I believe. I think I have this correct. Gregory will correct me if my notes are scrambled here. However, they work independent of reality, as far as I can tell. The one who touches Earth is Tureci, Mrs. Shaheen, but Shaheen doesn't seem to be aware that he's obsessed. Is that correct? I mean, the investor class puzzles about him as well.
These are quirky, interesting scientists, and they have interesting backgrounds as well. So Uygur Shaheen, he was born in Turkey. His family moved to Germany when he was young. And he spent decades on cancer research, and he had the belief, and he still does, that the immune system can be taught to fight off cancer. And his whole life is dedicated to cancer research and developing vaccines for cancer. And frankly, It hasn't worked yet. He started this company called BioNTech, and one of the methods they were using to teach the immune system was using mRNA. So Majerdan was all about mRNA. mRNA was one of the methods that BioNTech and Ugur Sahin were working on. And he's just a quirky individual. Like you said, fast forwarding just a little bit, he's very wealthy today, but he continues to live in an apartment with his wife. He doesn't own a car. He doesn't own a television. He schleps piles of paperwork and scientific papers, even his computer, forget about laptop, his hard drive. They send everything on vacations with them and lug them into the pool. These people are all about research. They're really not about getting wealthy. They're about solving the biggest challenges mankind faces, including cancer. So they got nervous about COVID. They've been working on this every day. They said, maybe we can be the ones to develop a vaccine. They turned on a dime when other people dragged their feet.
Yes, I want to emphasize, however, they were pursuing cancer as Baruch was pursuing AIDS.
Yes.
Moderna was pursuing drug therapies. In other words, nobody was pursuing the line eventually they will follow in order to solve COVID-19. Another thing about Sahin and Tarachi is they need money, and they're not experienced the way Bansal is about raising money. So they find a family. Is this the Strongmans of Germany? Is that how you say their name? The Strongmans?
Yes. Thomas Strongman. Yes.
And who believe in them. They're billionaires and they believe in them and they give them money. But even they grow frustrated with Sahin and Tureci's style. Why so? What did they, do they today congratulate them for being so odd?
Yes. But one can understand these companies that I write about and these scientists. None of them had ever proven their methods by late 2019, and they had spent years on honing and improving and advancing, but without much proof that they had vaccine approaches that were modern and new and different and would work. And it made sense that their own investors were getting a little frustrated. And that was true of Moderna. That was true of BioNTech. That was true of all the different approaches that I write about. So it makes a lot of sense. They spent years. They told everyone, you know, Stefan Bancel said to investors, hey, we've got the method that's going to save the world. And then everyone was like, right. We doubt you. We doubt Moderna and we doubt mRNA. And they doubted Ugur Sahin and Özlem Türeci and BioNTech as well.
The doubts persist. This is the investor class, and Gregory also works for the Wall Street Journal, but he's not composing wonderful books. And the market is watching all of this, not because of COVID. That will come up later in the century, but because the drugs or the therapies or the vaccines they're developing have potential, but not all of them do in the same fashion. So you have to, when you form a lab, you have to be conscious of where you're going to get your money. And a subplot of Gregory's book is how Big Pharma works. Big Pharma is really just a compilation of little pharma ideas, not unlike Silicon Valley. You have a great idea and you either later on will sell it to Microsoft or Facebook, or you'll stay solitary and develop it on your own and hope other colleagues come in with you. Now we go to another difficult personality, extremely difficult personality. This is at Oxford University, Adrian Hill. What do we need to know about Adrian Hill other than, oh, yes, I know. What is a Marmite personality, Gregory?
Yes. Adrian Hill has been chasing malaria vaccine for years. Again, Dan Baruch chasing AIDS, Ugur Sahin cancer. The particular obsession of this gentleman, Adrian Hill, at the University of Oxford, has been malaria. He also tried to develop other kinds of vaccines. And for years, he made incremental progress, didn't develop any kind of vaccine or drug that worked. And yet, he developed this attitude, this perspective, this confidence that he exhibited left and right. And he got to the point where he was becoming difficult to everyone. He's a very critical individual. He would stand up at conferences and just rip into colleagues, peers, their work. How dare you? What are you thinking? This is a dumb idea. Just, he grated on people. Some people were okay with criticism. Hey, this is a scientific process. We can criticize each other. We're trying to arrive at a correct answer and improve our methods. But other people were taken aback. He was obnoxious. He was really obnoxious and got to the point where he was really unliked in the world of science. And yet he was pretty convinced he was making progress. He and his colleagues were making an approach, and their approach was a little bit like Dan Baruch's in Boston. The Oxford University approach was using a different virus, not this harmless cold virus that Dan Baruch is using called AD26, which he used for AIDS, but using Adrian Hill and his colleagues used a chimpanzee virus, believe it or not, a virus that affects chimpanzees. And there's a good reason for it. There's a lot of similarities between us, mankind and humans and chimpanzees. And we have never, because it's a chimpanzee virus, the idea was we've never seen this virus before, so our bodies won't fight it off. It could deliver a genetic payload to the immune system. And Adrian Hill would get up and be obnoxious and offend people left and right throughout the industry. But back in the labs, he was making progress on this really obscure and controversial approach.
I know I'm reading too much into these things, Gregory, because I'm accustomed to reading novels. But it really strikes me that we have a similarity between Adrian Hill and Stefan Bansal and Dan Baruch. I'm not sure Sahin spends a lot of time with anger, but they're generally explosive individuals when they don't get their way.
Yes, I think it comes with being ambitious, having really high expectations of themselves, but also of their colleagues, and not suffering fools easily. And that you can say of all of them. Some are maybe more pleasant and more likable than others. You know, the interesting thing is they're not black and white characters. And as you know from my books, I'm not a fan of black and white characters. I don't think there are too many of them that exist. So Adrian Hill, as hard as he was on people in the industry, and as disliked as he remains to his younger colleagues at University of Oxford, he's actually very supportive and friendly and helpful. So none of these people, and same thing with Stefan Bansal. Yes, he fires people. Yes, he pushes people. But today, his people find him very inspirational, and he can be very supportive as well. So none of these characters are necessarily people you want to bring home and bring home to your mom or have a beer with, but they also are people that have a lot of really great qualities as well. I love that the great aspect of these characters.
Moderna, J&J will eventually work with Dan Baruch, and we'll evidence that. BioNTech will work with Pfizer. We have here a range of successes in the future. Nobody knows it at the time. We have one more to introduce, Novavax. When we come back, Gail Smith and Insects. This is CBSI on the World. The book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. Gregory Zuckerman of the Wall Street Journal is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World and my conversation with Gregory Zuckerman, the Wall Street Journal special correspondent, but the author of a new book, A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. These are pursuits by big pharma, big personalities, simultaneously, not knowing in their future, in the beginning of 2020, will be a pandemic that is a global catastrophe that may or may not be solvable. Right now, we have a remedy, what these men and women produce. Novavax is one company that Gregory dubs at one point the little company that couldn't. But before we get to Novavax, we need to spend time with Gail Smith from North Dakota, a man who seems another genius, who seems self-taught, but his methodology is based on insect cells. How so, Gregory?
Yeah, so Gail Smith's a fascinating guy, as you said, from little town in North Dakota. And he becomes convinced that insect cells and insect viruses can actually be really helpful. You can create vaccines. He realized, not many people did at the time, but insects and humans are much more alike than, you know, most people presume. They both require oxygen. They both have, there's some anatomical similarities. They both have, you know, brains and hearts and reproductive organs. And he thought that if you could use an insect virus, which are, as I call, they call them roomy. In other words, there's room in there. In the virus, you take it and you place, you can put genetic message in the virus and you put it into an insect cell. you could create proteins. And the whole idea is create a protein from a virus, from a pathogen, from anything, an illness, anything you want to protect from. And once you've created that protein, then you can inject it into the body, teach the immune system to be unawares for it, and then protect from whatever virus that protein represents. So he created this new effort. It eventually did lead to a lot of vaccines that we use today for HPV, for shingles. They all use this, it's called a protein subunit, basically using a protein, creating a protein from those viruses, from those diseases. You inject them in the body and you create protection from shingles, from HPV, etc. That's due to Dale Smith. And he did a lot of really interesting work. He got wealthy and he joined this little company called Novavax in Maryland, and they let him do his thing. And here he was laboring away literally for years and years and years in the bowels of this basement in suburban Maryland. And he had this approach that he thought could work on all kinds of different vaccines. They failed and failed and failed, this company Novavax, over the years for everything, RSV, Zika, you name it. They tried to create a vaccine for it and it failed. But Gail Smith thought he was making progress. And come early 2020, he said, guys, I think I can create a vaccine against this new virus, this new coronavirus.
Well, we now have the makings of the pursuers. So we started with the event in China, in Shanghai, when the researcher, Dr. Zhang, mapped out the genome. We've assembled the cast. However, the cast is not, at this point, engaged because heretofore, viruses can come and go. And if you turn your enormous apparatus towards a virus that could suddenly disappear, you've wasted time and money. Most importantly, you've broken the pattern that established your pursuit of cancer or AIDS or malaria. And so what is the event that persuades everybody they've got to move? There's no one event. It's a global phenomenon. But Gregory tells the story of what happens in the New York area. This is a man named Garbuz who is suddenly stricken with what we now know as COVID-19. It happens in February 2020. Remember, the January is when Zhang identifies the genome and it's communicated by the internet to all these researchers. What do we need to know about how the United States reacted to Garbuz? We have about a minute, Gregory.
Well, we all reacted slowly in the United States. The administration at the time kind of downplayed this virus. Wasn't even their fault necessarily. We just had the testing capabilities. We were unprepared, even though there have been warnings for many years. Later on, you got to give the Trump administration credit for Operation Warp Speed, which was quite helpful. But in early 2020, you and I weren't ready. We were caught unawares. Our government was as well. And yet we didn't realize that all the people I write about in my book, they were turned on a dime and they said, no, this is going to be dangerous. We need to be the ones to save the day. And they stepped up, to their credit.
They stepped up, but it didn't happen overnight. They had to convince their bosses. They had to convince their families. They had to convince themselves. So we're going to turn to that story. Remember, now this is a pursuit that not everybody's organized. I joke with Gregory. It's at the moment in The Body Snatchers when Kevin McCarthy goes into the phone booth having escaped the monsters, and he asks for the White House. He wants to tell them that the Body Snatchers are taking all of our personalities. We've been invaded from another world. However, you can imagine in 2020, the White House doesn't take the call. Nobody takes the call. Merck does it. Gregory, that's one of the most amazing things. Merck, the biggest company of all, doesn't take the call.
I agree. Merck is the one you would have thought would step up to create these vaccines. MMR, the measles, rubella vaccine that we all trust and rely on, that's from Merck. Other giants too, Sanofi, GSK. But Merck had internal discussions, and I write about it in the book, about whether to pursue a vaccine and for COVID-19. And they thought about it. They deliberated. There was a rift within the executive ranks and within the scientists. But they kind of said, you know what, we're making progress on things like cancer. We don't know if this is going to be pandemic. We don't know how long it's going
to
last.
Well, here come the heroes. A shot to save the world. The inside story of the life or death race for COVID-19 vaccine. Gregory Zuckerman. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Zuckerman. His new book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for COVID-19 vaccine. All these men and women who are alerted in January of 2020, where do they come from? We go first to Moderna, which is itself a combination of pursuits, anxieties, pride, accident. We take Moderna and we come down to one man, Stefan Bancel, who's born in Marseille. Gregory, this is an outsized personality. He's not a scientist. How is it that Bancel comes to run the company called Moderna? What is his life's ambition? What is his style?
So, John, the reason I began writing this book is I became so fascinated by this guy, Bancel, and his firm, and how unlikely it was that Moderna should be the one to step up and save millions of lives. So Stefan Bancel, as you say, is not a scientist. He's an engineer, Harvard MBA. He becomes the CEO of this startup called Moderna, and they're dedicated, they're focused on developing messenger RNA, this molecule, using it to develop either drugs or vaccines or both. And for years they struggle, and for years Stefan Bancel is hard on his employees. He pushes them. He drives them to the point where people literally are collapsing. I write about it in the book, in the parking lot, in the office, at home, hitting their heads, being rushed to emergency rooms or trying to keep up with the guy, and they're having difficulties. He fires people. He's hard on people. He's not very especially complimentary. He's got ups and downs. He becomes very emotional. Sometimes he's celebrating, and sometimes he's despondent when they have setbacks. And he in some ways is a kind of a Steve Jobs kind of character. He inspires people at the same time. His belief is that Moderna can save lives, and they're going to be the ones in the next crisis to do so. And people on the outside are skeptical. They don't believe him. He seems a little bit like a Elizabeth Holmes kind of character, a salesman, raises tons and tons of money, but they're very secretive as a firm. People on the outside are very suspicious. And we get to the point in to the end of 2019 where they had gone public. The stock is down. They're starting to cut costs. The pressure is building on Bancel and his firm, and they still have not proven to the world that they can develop either a vaccine or a drug that's effective and protective.
The doubts were because of messenger RNA. And Gregory takes us back to the beginning of this story, if there is a beginning. It's really a conversation held over many years between schools, between researchers, between what are called labs. When you get a grant, you set up a lab and you hire assistants. Messenger RNA was always seen as a possibility for fooling the body to think that you can let us in. You don't have to fight us. We've got something new for you. We can train you so you can resist a virus. But it was easily rejected. It was very difficult to introduce. And you introduce us to two researchers. I want to bring them in, Gregory, because they can get lost in the swim here. Carrico and Weissman, who first meet at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital in the 20th century, and they believe in messenger RNA, but nobody else does. I get the feeling, Gregory, that today, if we went to one of these big drug companies and said, you know, let's use messenger RNA, despite the success, people would still doubt it. Do I read that correctly?
Yes, many would. I'll tell you why, and I'll tell you what's remarkable about all their work. So basically, messenger RNA is a molecule. We have it inside us. It delivers the instructions, the message, as it were, from the DNA to the part of the cell where proteins are created to keep us alive. And the dream had always been, well, what if instead we created mRNA, created this molecule in the lab to instruct our body to do anything we wanted? We could actually transform our bodies into drug factories. You want some sort of protein that's at the heart of some shot, some vaccine or some drug? We can give it an instruction in the lab, put it in a vaccine, inject it in the body, and ta-da. And that was always the dream, but also people were skeptical for good reasons. mRNA is chopped up really quickly by the cell's enzymes. It lasts just moments, so it's really unstable. It's not something you want to really depend on. The conventional wisdom in the world of science is don't waste your time with mRNA. And as you suggest, there were these two stubborn, persistent scientists at Penn who ignored, forget about the conventional wisdom, they ignored their own colleagues. They ignored the administrators at Penn who said, stop wasting your time on mRNA. And Carrico and Weissman persisted. And they figured out a way to change the chemical basis of this molecule, mRNA, just a little bit. Switching one chemical, it's called uridine, for another one called pseudouridine. And suddenly this mRNA was able to evade the immune system and get into the cells. And why do we want that? Well, then they could instruct the cells to do, they thought, pretty much anything you want. You want to create a protein, you could do it. And it was a remarkable, breakthrough that has changed everything and showed a way, where we could start using mRNA to maybe make therapeutics and vaccines.
Though Carrico and Weissman do not get the company they want to build on their discovery, dated 2005, Moderna, which is a combination of modified and RNA, you get it? It sounds like modern, but it's Moderna. Moderna follows this methodology, and Bansal believes in it, but they're pursuing drugs, not vaccines. Why drugs, Gregory? What is their ambition?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what's interesting about my book is I look at it as sort of it's a relay race in some ways, where someone runs a lap, is strong, some team, some scientist, and then they stumble and fall and they barely pass the baton to the next team. And that's kind of what happened. Carrico and Weissman looked like they were going to be the ones, and they failed. They couldn't raise money. They couldn't convince anyone. They never developed any kind of drug. It's not even clear what they did would have. It was an approach that in concept was a great one, but there was a lot more work that needed to be done. That's what happened at Moderna. And it was the kind of thing where Moderna and Bansal spent years making improvements. And as you suggest, first they tried drugs. And originally the company was called Moderna Therapeutics, not vaccines, because therapeutics, drugs, are kind of what drug companies want to develop. Vaccines are kind of, until this last year, were seen as a loser kind of business. Vaccines are given every year, once a lifetime maybe, every once in a blue moon. There's just so much you can charge for a vaccine. You get pressure, you get criticism if you charge too much, especially in third world countries. Whereas a drug, you know, a statin, every day you take a statin. So for years, Moderna, Bansal and his colleagues tried to develop effective drugs using this messenger RNA molecule, and they failed.
We'll leave them with failure, Gregory. We'll come back to this. The book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. Next up, a genius. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Zuckerman. His new book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. We've watched the American companies, but Oxford is now teamed up with a European company, AstraZeneca. Remember, you need to R&D it. And Oxford is using the AD approach, the adenovirus approach that J&J is using. That would make it possible for one shot and not a series of shots. That would also make it possible to create a vaccine that is easily transported. That's important for the world that is not well-to-do or has an infrastructure for keeping vaccines cool as they're delivered, as we have here in North America or in Northern Europe. However, Oxford has AstraZeneca to manufacture the vaccine when they develop it. The trouble is they have also the same trouble raising money. Hill and Gilbert are very confident, perhaps too confident. At one point, Gregory, you tell the story that they were ready to send a representative to see the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. Was there reluctance on the British government's part to believe in Oxford?
Well, I think it was reluctance early on among experts, government bodies, including in the UK, to believe this thing would be serious. I mean, it took a while for most of us to acknowledge the possibility of a pandemic. And yeah, I write about early on Adrian Hill, this much detested scientist in Europe who is very ambitious, and he's got a really interesting approach to potentially save lives. He wants to create a vaccine. He and his colleague Sarah Gilbert Others do too. It took them, frankly, a few weeks also to get serious about it. There was a younger scientist that was prodding them and nudging them, and finally they got on board. But yeah, they needed the money, and it took them a little while. It's funny that one of the subplots, and I think you mentioned earlier, my whole book, it's about money. And you know, it's a book about science, obviously, but you need the money to be able to pull off the science, and it's always a struggle. So yeah, early on it was for Adrian Hill and his colleagues, but then they got the money and they were in the lead. They were the ones that were acknowledged by US bodies, UK bodies, European bodies. They were going to be the ones that were going to save us all. And they had the best shot with this approach.
They had a method others will imitate. They put phase one and phase two together. What does that mean? What is phase one, phase two, phase three? How does it work, Gregory?
So yeah, so to develop any kind of drug or vaccine, generally speaking, there are three phases. The phase one where you're testing it, and phase two as well, where you're testing it in mammals. You're testing not necessarily for efficacy. You're testing for safety. You're getting signals. You're getting signs of efficacy, but you're really just making sure they're safe and as possible, and that there are signs within mammals, monkeys, mice, etc., of creating, in this case, neutralizing antibodies, as they call them, antibodies that can be effective and protective. So you're not really sure until phase three. So all the writing I do, that the drama that leads up to the phase three trials, and there's a lot of it, these scientists from all over the world, including Adrian Hill in Oxford, they think they've got vaccines they're going to work on in the coronavirus, but they're not 100% sure until they get these phase threes.
They're being driven by the death toll. They're being driven by the fear in all the nations. This is a time when no one was traveling, or very few people were traveling, when there was lockdown routinely across the United States, across Europe, into other parts of the world that we can only guess at. They're seeing these headlines every day. The prime minister is about to come down with COVID-19, and he's very ill. So it's pushing everybody in to develop Oxford AstraZeneca. However, it's not really a mistake, Gregory. It's part of their need to produce a vaccine that's going to save lives. They test, I think it's phase three, on people 18 to 55. Why is that a mistake?
Well, listen, there are all kinds of arguments you can make either way. It's not clear in hindsight what they should have done. But the whole point is, You've got to test in tens of thousands of people. There was a debate how many you needed to really test, but all these efforts realized over time. You've got to reassure people. I mean, there already was worried about vaccine hesitancy. Eventually, there was even more so. They knew that if they didn't test it enough people, that there'd be concerns on the part of the public, or even more than there eventually were. So eventually, they all arrived at the conclusion that you're going to need tens of thousands of people, 30 to 40,000 or so, that were in these phase three trials.
And in testing just that narrow band, they missed out on
yes.
troubles they're going to have with older people, such as myself.
Exactly. So the Oxford group didn't do a good job of including older candidates, older volunteers. There's a debate as to why. It's not important right now. But that was one of many stumbles that they made. I describe a number of all others. So they were in the lead, and due to this decision, but others as well, they stumbled. Like I said, in this relay race, they were in the race and in the lead, and then they kind of tripped a few times.
We go to BioNTech. Now, Sahin and Tureci have the good luck of being teamed up with a big pharma giant, Pfizer. Credit Pfizer. Once they were in, they were all the way in, Gregory. They believed in the RNA, having spent years not believing in the RNA. That was a conversion process, I guess, under the pressure of the news. Is that why it happened?
Yeah, to their credit, the senior scientists, some of them within Pfizer, yes, there was some skepticism on the part about mRNA, but others were more excited. You know, it's a big place and a lot of brain power there. And there were enough people that did get convinced that Sahin and BioNTech had a shot, no pun intended, at creating an effective vaccine. And they got behind BioNTech. And frankly, we should all be thankful that they did. It wasn't clear what happened. As you suggest, early on, some of the scientists were dragging their feet and were reluctant. And it could have gone a different way. Just like I said with Moderna, maybe not getting enough money to produce these vaccines, it wasn't clear that BioNTech would find a partner. They did find one in Pfizer, and we should all be thankful.
Sahin is an individual who is a unique individual. he tried the RNA method, but he was only taking a slice of the spike protein, not the whole spike protein, which was Moderna's approach. I believe eventually they talked him out of that. Is that, but he could still be developing that, Gregory. We don't know where he's going.
Right. So that's another reason we should be grateful. There was a debate within Pfizer and between Pfizer and BioNTech about how to create this vaccine and whether you want to create the entire spike protein or a part of the spike protein in the body. In the end, they decided, they included that the entire one was the most effective route, and it worked out well. It's not clear what would happen had they chosen the different route, but there were all kinds of ways. You know, we don't appreciate these vaccines and what happened enough. It could have gone wrong in so many times, so many different ways.
We have two RNA methodologies. One, adenovirus. Now, J&J is also using the adenovirus, but they have a reason for it. This is July 2020. They're using AG26, the cold virus, and they're looking to lower success for shots because they want one shot to satisfy everyone. Do they originally, J&J, understand that their vaccine will be most successful in the developing world?
Well, I think they wanted to be the first and the best in the West as well, but they did realize that they've got an advantage with their shots and that they are cheaper, but they don't have to be kept at cold temperatures like the mRNA ones, like the Pfizer and Moderna ones. And yes, the J&J ones and the AstraZeneca ones, because they've got this different approach using this harmless virus, it's a different and unique approach, and it doesn't have to be kept in these temperatures. And it's, as a result, it's much easier to handle in poorer areas. And I think we need to acknowledge that they are playing really important roles in those countries. And I think they're going to increasingly do so in the months ahead, in the years ahead.
It's your impression then from your reporting that J&J saw that as a goal to.
Oh, that was an advantage. It was something unique about their vaccine. But they also weren't sure that the others would work. The mRNA ones would work. It's a fascinating dynamic where all these competitors I write about in my book, they're racing, they're chasing each other. They want to be the first, and yet they don't want other people stumbling either, because let's say one of these vaccines was harmful, then it would have raised all kinds of questions about all the vaccines.
All right, here
and
comes
it would increase hesitancy.
Here comes the payoff. Shot to save the world. Gregory Zuckerman is the author. This is John Patrick.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Zuckerman. A Shot to Save the World is his new book, The Inside Story of the Life or Death Race for COVID-19 Vaccine. The competitors, one to go, Novavax, the little company that couldn't. Novavax is following Gail Smith's genius with the insects, and Novavax is the laggard. Novavax is not going to catch up, but the advantage here is that Novavax is also of a vaccine that can be easily transported and can be used worldwide. So I wanted to cite that not everything goes to the, if it's the hare, the rabbit and the hare, Gregory, it's good to be slow-footed here, because you have opportunities that are going to develop over many years. We don't know where Novavax has gone, but they were down, they had 30 or 40 cents in the till when they finally broke through. Is that how low, how little money did they have at the end, Gregory?
Yeah, I love the Novavax story, frankly. So here's this company that spent years failing. They tried to make vaccines for pretty much everything, HIV, SARS, swine flu, Ebola, MERS, you name it. They tried to create a vaccine and they couldn't. This guy, Gail Smith, is the head scientist there. And yet they still believed in their approach, creating a protein in the labs, injecting it, and then teaching the immune system. And then they turned down a dime in early January 2020. And as you suggest, at that point, they were running out of money. They had only about 4 or 5 months of cash left before they were going bankrupt. Employees were sending resumes out. It wasn't clear. They were taking one last chance with a flu vaccine. It wasn't clear they were going to stay alive. And yet they believed in their method. And they turned down a dime and said, you know what? Let's see if we could create a coronavirus vaccine. And it took a little while, and they had all kinds of setbacks, and the Operation Warp Speed kicked them out of the manufacturing plant they were working in, and they had to find another one. And, but they did succeed in developing a vaccine that looks really protective and effective. And we don't really need it in the West, but we do need it elsewhere, partly because it's cheap, partly because it doesn't have to be kept at cold temperatures, and partly because it does really look very protective. So assuming this little company, obscure, overlooked, underwhelming for many years company in Maryland can manufacture enough of these vaccines, they could be the ones to save millions in places like Africa and Asia.
Because the story's not done. Gregory's giving us the beginning of the story. Other companies are now participating in the pursuit of a better vaccine or remedies for COVID-19, which at this point, I tell myself listening to me in the future, we don't know whether it's going to become endemic or remain a pandemic or whether there'll be another iteration. We don't know. At this point, manufacturing these vaccines, they don't know about the Delta variant. They don't know about the way that the virus will change as it spreads around the planet. They don't know about how seasonal differences will matter. They just want something that is going to work in their trials, their phase 3 trials, because that will give them the green light to use this for the public. It is now we come to the dramatic moment. This is, I've talked about the movies. Gregory's book is perfect for the scene of wildfire in Andromeda Strain. That happened earlier with Jean calling his friend Holmes in Australia. I've talked about the invasion of the body snatchers when Kevin McCarthy calls the White House and the White House doesn't call him back or they won't take his phone call. Okay, now we come to a moment that the science fiction movies never like because it's about success, you know? It's about defeating the monsters. It is now November, I believe it's November 8th, yes, we're at Pfizer. Pfizer is a giant. You know, if there's a solar system somewhere without Pfizer, it's not going to be healthy. You need Pfizer to be healthy. You need Merck to be healthy. But Pfizer board, everybody involved, the bosses, the people listening are like, Gregory, what I thought of is how families wait for announcements about whether their child got into a school or not. You know, that's what it felt like. Everybody's sitting around trying to pretend they're not really nervous, but they hadn't slept the night before. So take us into what was a boardroom listening for a phone call from another Pfizer employee who is going to hear information from the government. Is that who's doing making the original phone call of the results of phase 3 trial? Where is the boardroom?
Yeah, so there's a group of executives in a Westchester Pfizer office, and it's about a dozen of them, maybe 10 or so. They've got some food they're picking at, but no one has any appetite, and no one slept, and they're trying to make small talk, and they're all they're trying to act relaxed, but they're not, and they're basically counting down to getting the data, the results from the phase 3, the all-important trial to see if their vaccine actually works, and they realize that the data isn't just important for Pfizer. It's important for mankind because they've got this mRNA approach, which Moderna does too. So in other words, if Pfizer fails or just has really weak, disappointing results, then Moderna probably will too. And that means this pandemic is probably going to last years. So they could not be more nervous and scared. And they're waiting and they're trying to, and they get the call. Well, they're waiting for, they have a colleague who's in touch with the independent committee that has the data. And they're waiting and time drags on an hour, hour and a half, even longer. They keep waiting for this woman. Her name is Catherine Jansen to tell them the results. And they're sending texts, you know, what is it? When are you calling? And she texts back, hang on, guys. And they're like, wait, hang on. Is that good news or bad news? Wait, maybe that's bad news. If we don't have any results yet. They're trying to read into it. They can't even figure it out. Finally, they get the results and their vaccine is 95%. Protective and the room explodes. They hug each other. The CEO literally says, I love you. I love you. He can't help himself. He's not clear who he's saying it and telling that to. It's a really remarkably dramatic scene. Yeah.
What they're waiting for is this vast trial that they put out, phase 3. They give the vaccine to some people and other people don't get it, but nobody knows. And when of this group, they look at how many actually come down with the virus. And they want to know, did that person receive their vaccine or not? If the majority of them did receive the vaccine and they got the virus in any event, it's a failure. If the majority of them do not get the virus and they receive the vaccine, it's a success. But there are degrees here. So what we're looking at with 94.5%, to be specific, 90-95 means maybe one person in the group got the vaccine and got the virus. Sunday, November 8th is the date I have for Pfizer. That's Pfizer.
Yes.
Moderna is going to go through a week later. Notice the horse race. The horse race is now coming down to the final steps. Pfizer has the vast ability to manufacture. They have everything working. They don't have to beg for the money. Moderna has one route. That's Juan Andres with the three refrigerators. But they're ready to be successful or failure as well. So it is now Sunday, November 15th. Stefan Bancel and Stephen Hoge, is that the name? That's the name of the president.
Yes.
They're waiting for results, and they're equally nervous and in denial, especially Bancel. This is the payoff. He's a very wealthy man, but something else drives him, Gregory. Do we know what it is?
Oh, ambition, changing the world, helping lives, saving lives, getting even wealthier. There are all kinds of motivations for all my characters.
Did he know that on the 15th, did he know that Pfizer had already received the positive call?
Yes. So on the one hand, Bancel and Hoge, that was a good sign for them. Well, if Pfizer's 95% and they also have mRNA approach, then maybe we could be something closer to that. But on the other hand, can you imagine the pressure they're feeling? They have to keep up with Pfizer. This is Pfizer, the giant. They've got, you know, thousands of scientists working there, and they're working with BioNTech on this thing, and little Moderna's trying to keep up, and they're worried their vaccine is not going to come close to 95%, and they just want to get somewhere close, so it's not an embarrassing comparison with Pfizer.
So on the 15th, they get a phone call, and the phone call is positive. What is their rating from the phase three trials?
Well, you know, there's a lot of drama that day too. So Stephen Hogue's the one who is on a Zoom call, and he's waiting and he's looking at the faces of the committee members for some sign. Guys, put a smile on your face. Yeah, why are you looking so downbeat? Maybe that means we have bad results.
I think some of them were checking their emails. They weren't even paying attention to the announcement.
Yeah, because they knew the results already, this committee, and they spend hours and hours discussing them, etc. So by then, they were kind of bored. The committee was bored. But Stephen Hoge, this is his whole life's work. Their whole future of the pandemic is depending on this. And so the last thing he wanted was people bored on the Zoom call. And that's what he's seeing. He's like, oh, my God, that's not a good sign. These people can't even stay interested enough to look at the camera here. Not a great sign. But then, as you suggest, get the data. It's great data. It's just as good, if not better, than Pfizer's. And he's like, wait, hold on here. This is crazy. And he doesn't even listen to what they're saying. He hears this number and he blanks out. And then he gets scared. He's like, oh, my God, I blanked out. And we're giving all these details that we're going to have to share with investors. We're going to get sued by the SEC because we didn't share enough information. And just because he blanked out, he didn't realize that later it was going to be an email with all the details. But he starts freaking out about that. So, yeah, they couldn't be happier. It's a home run. He texts his colleagues. It's a home run. It's a home run. 94.5%. And everyone explodes in the Moderna office as well.
We mentioned that the markets responded positively as well to all these decisions, and the ratings for phase three have all stood up. Now we go to November 23rd, 2020. This happened within easy memory. The announcement hits the Wall Street Journal about Oxford AstraZeneca. What is that announcement, Gregory?
Not nearly as good. Their approach is a fine one, but not nearly as protective as the mRNA vaccines. It's not, and also they don't present their data well. So on the one hand, it looks about 70% protective, but on the other hand, some people in their study had 90% or so protection, which is not far from the mRNA ones, and that's sort of the data that they emphasize, and then people start picking it apart right away. It looks like data mining. Why are you emphasizing this small group that got 90% protection? Why not the overall number, which is about 70% protection? It just blows up in their face, and frankly, it was an issue of public relations more than it was the vaccine. They just didn't convey their data in a clear enough fashion.
And Graham Hill didn't respond well. He was extremely rattled by this.
Well, listen, to Hill, he's a scientist. He's created, he and his colleagues have created this vaccine, which they think is very protective. And it's also a very cheap vaccine and inexpensive to produce compared with the mRNA one. So they say to themselves, hey, our vaccine is going to save lives all over the world. Why is everybody so critical of us? And there's good reason why people are critical. You can't isolate one piece of data in an overall study and say 90% of protection when it wasn't close to that. So there's reason why people are unhappy with Oxford and with AstraZeneca. But to Adrian Hill's credit, he says, we succeeded in creating a protective vaccine. Why is everybody so critical of me? And there's irony there because this guy, Adrian Hill, had spent his whole life being critical of others.
As I note that in the reporting in the Wall Street Journal, February, March, April, May of this year, 2021, AstraZeneca has become something of a political football between states because it's identified with Britain, gets mixed up with Brexit. A lot of prejudice comes out around this vaccine, but it is a successful vaccine, and it is now being exported to the world. Now we come February 27th is my date here, Gregory, 2021. The FDA gives J&J somewhere between 66 and 72% efficaciousness, and I believe that is also a success because of what we said earlier. J&J vaccine can go to the developing world because it doesn't require sophisticated transportation.
Yes, not just that, but also at that point you had Delta variant, so a 70% or so protection by the J&J vaccine, and it's a one-shot vaccine, so people love that. 70% protection from Delta variant is quite good, and it's something to cheer and appreciate. Yeah, so they were feeling on top of the world. Dan Baruch had spent his life chasing an HIV vaccine. It didn't work, but to his credit, he shifted gears and created this, helped create this vaccine and along with the J&J scientists, and it looked great.
Dan Baruch is still playing the violin, and he's still chasing the big one, AIDS. And so I'm sure if anybody's going to catch on, solve that puzzle, he will. All right, the little engine that couldn't, the little company that couldn't. It is now late January, Novavax, 2021. What are the results?
So they come out with results that are as good as anybody's. They've got also about 90% protective. It's also important to remember that there was the Delta variant at the time, so it looked that much better because it was in the 90s or around 90, I should say. But there was Delta going on at the time. And people subsequently have criticized them. They haven't been able to manufacture these vaccines in the sizes, and they haven't been approved yet. They haven't been even merged the authorization in the United States. And that's in large part because they couldn't find a partner. They didn't have a partner. They were doing it themselves, this little dinky company in Maryland. I do believe that in the months ahead, they will be authorized in countries around the world, and they will go into arms around the world, and they will be really effective and helpful vaccines for large parts of the world.
The book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. Gregory Zuckerman is the author. When we come back, lessons learned and questions to be answered going forward about a pandemic that is not solved, is mitigated, but not solved. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Zuckerman, the Wall Street Journal reporter, whose new book is A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. The questions to be answered include the original question about the origins of COVID-19. Gregory's book examines all possibilities, and there's no resolution here. But because he's done all of this reporting, I ask him, is it important to these heroes, the men and women of these companies who produced the vaccine, is the origin important to them, Gregory, or have they gotten something else out of this that is useful for the future, which is the methodology? I can't tell.
Yeah, they don't really focus on the origins. They believe that it was likely naturally a spillover from an animal. We'll eventually find the animal host. But quite honestly, these are researchers who are just focused on trying to develop vaccines that are protective. And they're more focused on using their methods to fight new diseases and illnesses, really intractable, difficult ones, things like cancer, things like malaria, things like HIV still, Dan Baruch, RSV, but various viruses. And I'm very optimistic. I don't want to say confident, optimistic about the future. But in terms of the origins, they believe the mainstream view in science remains that it was likely from an animal that spilled over. There's a possibility that it leaked out of a lab in China. I personally am an Occam's razor kind of guy. So I'm of the belief that it likely we will eventually find the animal host, just like it did with HIV. I mean, you remember there were all kinds of suspicions and accusations. It was the CIA, the U.S. government, KGB. Eventually we found the animal host. I believe that will be the same thing with this virus as well.
And the subplot of your story, the markets. We've touched on this, Gregory, but I want to go back to it. Without the markets, there is no government that had enough money to validate all of these pursuits or to deal with personalities as creative as these. It was the marketplace that believed in them, Moderna, but Pfizer is marketplace as well. It might be well-to-do, but it has to function in the world of stocks. So I want to acknowledge that Wall Street's a winner here too, Gregory, and I think we should always remember that when we come up against the next pandemic.
So, John, I've spoken to the CEOs of these companies, executives, researchers, and there are a lot of them are foreign-born. Ugur Sahin, Albert Bourla, the Pfizer CEO, Stefan Bancel, and they all say that these vaccines could not have been produced elsewhere without American backing. And we're talking investors. Only in America can you get IPOs of both these companies without any proof, any earnings, any revenue. In America, you still have venture capitalists, you've got individual investors, you've got mutual funds, hedge funds, et cetera, who are willing to roll the dice on really good ideas and approaches or promising ones without any proof. So we need to acknowledge that, yes, these vaccines are modern science's greatest achievement, but I would argue modern finances too. And, you know, we need to be a little more appreciative, I think, of the role that big Wall Street played as well as, you know, big pharma.
I want to be appreciative of Stefan Bancel. We'll go back to where we started, Gregory. Bancel's personality is amazing. If there's anybody going to get us to a Mars colony, it's Bancel's personality. He does not accept success as adequate.
Yeah. And John, I have to tell you, the foot's still pedal to the metal over there at Moderna and Beyond Tech. These people, they've made billions of dollars. Some of them are actual billionaires, Stefan Bancel and others, but they're not letting up. I still talk to the researchers and others there, and they're going all out. They're obviously still very focused on the coronavirus and creating more vaccines, but they're focusing on the next challenge. And again, be it cancer, be it turning off our immune system when we need to instead of turning it on for things like autoimmune diseases, things like that. I can't wait to see what they do. And you make a really good point. Maybe you need a Steve Jobs type personality like Stefan Bancel to do something this remarkable.
Gregory Zuckerman is the author of the new book, A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. We're halfway, we're some of the way along to solving COVID-19. And it's men and women in Gregory's book who will be there at the close of this crisis. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.